April 10th. It's a public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services, Health Services. There's several things going on today. Some of the caucuses have been late getting out. We do have several members who have been on the other committee that are in trying to work on their legislative packages. And then I believe that Representative Smith will be, Tootie Smith will be late. And I know I ran into Senator Carter, and we were late getting off the floor. Some of us have just ran to lunch within the last 15 minutes or so. But I wanted to go ahead and start the meeting so that I don't disturb the rest of you. And just to our housekeeping items, cell phones, make sure they're turned off so that we don't disrupt the proceedings. And Rosie and Rosette, although they were not here yesterday, they have reappeared today, welcome the acronyms and the contribution. You should know that Rosette was a contribution by Miss Katie back there, who thought that Rosie needed a companion. And, since it was the blue pig, to make all things gender equal, there's a pink pig. So I just wanted you to know that the contribution came from members of the Health Services Department. So with that, Mr. Britton, would you comment on what you have before you on the table of contents?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've handed out three items. The first is from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. One of the panel members had asked for a listing of type A hospitals and type B hospitals, and that's what this is. The second thing that I handed out, which I believe Mr. Cast will be reviewing with us first, is an overview of the central administration budget within the health services cluster of the Department of Human Services. It is a handout that has an organizational chart on the front of it. Finally, what I handed out was follow-up questions and materials, follow-up to some questions and materials with respect to the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. It's a fairly thick packet, and I think Barry and some others may be going over that after we're done with the central admin overview. And I believe there are a couple more of these things, two more that are on their way. They're being printed right now for public health and for Oregon Health Plan.
Very good. Thank you, Barry.
Madam Chair, my name is Barry Cast, Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services for Health Services, and I wonder if I might inquire about the tracking from that you've been discussing with our staff about the 0103, 0305 comparison, which was a subject of some concern last week. Is that available to members, or how are?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Madam Chair and Barry, we met this morning to review extensive spreadsheets with Mr. Naughton and John Swanson, the budget manager for the health services cluster. We can make them available. I would tell you, though, that they're fairly detailed and lengthy, and we would be happy to make them available if they are requested by members. I think we had a fruitful discussion with Mr. Wright, who is Senator Morse's legislative assistant, and Mr. Swanson was able to walk us through and to note some changes that will need to be made ultimately, but I thought it was a good exercise, and it went fairly well.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Do
you have any other questions, Chair?
No, Madam Chair. I just want to note for the record that in the Legislative Fiscal Office summary of the health services budget, there was a question raised by Senator Morse about the comparison between 0103 and 0305. Those numbers have been further explored and reviewed, and I'm going to be working solely from the 0305 budget. I think to track from one to the other, considering the number of changes in the budget, as well as the reorganization of the Department of Human Services, may give the wrong impression. And I don't know how to address that myself without getting into those details, and I can't competently do that, so I won't do it.
Okay.
Let me then direct you to this.
I do, since that was a question that was raised on the record, it might be well that the information and the walkthrough is be shared with the other members so that they, too, have a better understanding of what has occurred. I would prefer that than to have just one member knowing what's taking place and the other member left the question mark.
Madam Chair, would you like those spreadsheets? You want to see them first?
Yes, I want to see them first and see how much of it can be reduced down to a straightforward, uncomplicated number.
I think that's the key.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I've been invited to the table John Swanson, the administrator of the budget for health services, in the event that we need his assistance in bringing any detail to this discussion. But let me draw your attention to the document that Mr. Britton has distributed, which is a description of central administration. And before I get there, let me point out that the Legislative Fiscal Office discussion combines what's called program support with central administration. And lest there be any misunderstanding, let me again say for the record that the department's budgets are divided into three segments. The first is called program, and program includes all special payments. It basically does not include department staff. The only exception to that are the two state hospital programs, because we treat them as if they were providers in our system, and those enterprises are, in a sense, freestanding. Program support includes the field for the department, but in our case, it also includes the program offices that make sure that these services are properly supported and run, does investigations. I'll give you some examples of that. Included in program support is the public health laboratory. We have about 75 staff at the laboratory, and most of them are clinical people who are doing tests on samples and so forth. They really are not administrators, but for the purposes of this budget, they're not considered program specific either. Also included are the investigators that do our abuse and neglect investigations, staff who work with counties around alcohol and drug prevention, vital statistics staff, and the like. And in order that there not be a misunderstanding, of the $313 million in combined funding, $169 million of that is considered program support for those kinds of functions that I just described. So what we're talking about in reference to this document is the balance. It's about $144 million total funds and $29 million general fund. Some of those resources are matched, and that can be provided to the committee. The extent of that matching revenue can be provided to the committee. Of the $144 million in administration, $135 million of that total fund expenditure is in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And I want to point out that the entire Office of Medical Assistance Program staff is considered central administration. That's not true in the public health offices or in the Office of Mental Health and Addictions Programs. To refine that sum to the level of general fund, OMAP has $25 million general funds in central administration, and $4 million of the 29 total for central administration is in the other program offices. So I thought it would be helpful if we took a closer look for a moment at the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and I wonder if you could help me. I think the concern, Madam Chair, if I can just step back for a moment, is that to a person not familiar with this, the operation of an insurance company, a benefits management company, a large enterprise like the Office of Medical Assistance Programs with more than $3 billion in payments to health providers and other entities, that size of an administrative budget may seem challenging and might be questionable.
Mary, would you help me a minute, or John, on the Office of Medical Assistance Program, and it would be page...
I move directly to the fourth page in your package.
Okay, that's where I'm in the fourth. Okay. But if I go back to the last page, help me reconcile that. Is there something that isn't in the 135? Okay.
The back page, I made a correction this morning on it. It's 137. The back page is correct.
The back page is correct?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
So, 137.
So it is 137.
What I would like to illustrate, Madam Chair, is not the specific dollar amounts, but what the functions are that are performed that are considered administration. And I have asked John to make available to you some three pie charts that the Office of Medical Assistance Program has prepared for us. One shows the administrative budget of OMAP as a percent of total budget. And remember, the total budget is over $3 billion. The administrative budget looks like this. The first chart shows the administrative budget, which is 4% of the total budget for our Office of Medical Assistance Programs, including program and central administration. The next chart displays the percent of total budget, which are state funds. These are general funds and lottery funds and tobacco funds. And in that case, state funds only comprise 2% of the administrative costs from state funds only comprise 2% of the total. Finally, if you turn to the last pie chart, you'll see how the costs in administration are distributed. And I want to explain what these are. Staff is self-explanatory. We have 174 FTE, I believe. I want to make sure I've got the right number for your document, John. That's my understanding, is 174 FTE. At one time, the Office of Medical Assistance Programs had additional staff when the department reorganized and centralized some functions. For example, caseload projection, the level of staffing for that office declined, and those staff now report to other parts of the department, administrative services and finance and policy analysis. But for the 0305...
There, I just want to ask a question.
Yes.
And not that we're down to working on this budget yet or not, but when I see staff and I see administration from it, really, actually, we're talking about 18% of the budget going for administration. How do you separate?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Let me ask another question. How do you separate staff from administration?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, that's what we're trying to do so that you'll understand that.
Okay, all right. I will cool my jets.
My chart shows that the costs for staff for those 174 FTE are 16% of the administrative budget. Other costs include things like
Mr.
printing.
Just a moment,
yeah.
Barry.
Senator Carter and Madam Chair, as I understand it, the third pie chart, which shows staffing at 16%. That whole pie chart comprises the 2% of state funds, 4% of all funds. So it's a breakout of that administrative component all by itself, the third page. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
okay.
Thank
you, Mr. Britton. I was trying to point out that of the total OMAP budget, administration is 4%, and of that 4%, this is the distribution.
Right.
And since it's a lot of money, we thought it would be good for you to know what's in the 4%. And of that 4%, of the 100% of that segment, which is the central administration, staff are 16% of the cost. Other costs, which includes printing, mailing, distributing documents, attorney general costs, all the things that go into supporting the program, services and supplies, are 12%. Other services that we purchase under contract, for example, the disease management program from McKesson, our First Health benefits management, those contracts comprise 23% of the administrative costs. Those are services that are provided through contract rather than through state staff. And finally, nearly half of this administrative budget is comprised of what we call leverage funds. These are payments that we make to local districts, such as education service districts, school districts, local government, that are matched with funds that come from outside the general fund. And so half of this budget half of the total administration budget is really pass-throughs. And I think it gives a inflated impression of what our administrative costs are, since those funds are really spent and managed at the local level, even though in this budget they don't show as programmed. Let me ask if Mr. Swanson would like to clarify any of that, because we've been working on this to help you understand this for several days.
Thanks very much, Madam Chairman and committee members. My name is John Swanson. I'm the budget administrator for the Health Services Cluster, Department of Human Services. Barry is very accurate in his explanation. We wanted to make it very clear that a large part of this budget, when it was established and the structures were created, included these pass-throughs for the administrative Medicaid administrative matching for school districts, as well as some special payment pass-throughs that we will be making a technical adjustment to move to program, because it distorts the amount of administrative costs that we have. And so what I've done on the very last page of this display is to summarize all of the sub-offices within central administration, and then the subtotal there, as you can see, equals what we currently have in the governor's balanced budget of $134 million total fund. And then I extracted the pass-through amounts, which I'll be moving to program, because, as Barry mentioned, they are actually in the field, in the counties and the providers, to arrive at a $65 million, which I would consider is more indicative of the central admin cost, which is about 1.6% of our total budget, total funds.
John, you're on the last page.
I'm on the very last page. One thing else I would like to add is that the last thing I'm removing from this structure to make it a comparable number is a prorate that will be transferred within the department still. It will go to department-wide support services, but it will come out of this structure.
Just so I know that Senator Morris will probably have some questions, and if you're on the last page of the document that they handed out today, and it's to walk through some of the reconciliation that John is doing in order to more nearly come up with more accurate numbers, but may not be absolute. They're pretty.
I'm trying to get the 0103 numbers comparable to the 0305.
Right. So the last page, and I think there's what, 1, 2, 3. Three issues in that. If we look at the last set of numbers, and the one particularly is the Medicaid match for schools, which you're backing out because it really doesn't belong there.
I don't believe it should be in central administration.
And then the pass-through payments that were in central administration, you're taking those out. And then the prorate to transfer to
department-wide support services.
To the department-wide services is out. Are you tracking?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Senator Morris.
The $65 million, how does that relate to the page 8 document? I don't know how to characterize this. That shows central administration at $144.5 million.
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, if you refer to that last page that I'm talking about on the display,
yes.
if you'll follow down to total health services central administration,
there's
the 144.
Okay, excuse me. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
So, Madam Chair, what we have tried to do is track all of these resources into the appropriate expenditure area and make sure that they were understandable by the committee as you look at the budget during your upcoming work session. And I think, I don't know, Madam Chair, how fruitful it would be to go page by page.
This I think it would be very helpful.
As we describe the health services program for the department in the last 3 weeks, we are comprised of seven offices that are responsible for different parts of the health program and central administration. My office, central administration, is the cluster management for health services. And you can think of my position as being comparable to Ramona Foley's position, who was here before we started. My office consists of seven positions. I have a deputy who works for me. We have an operations chief. We have an operations chief who helps keep track of all the positions and all the budget authority we have and make sure that everything is properly administered from that perspective and relates to other parts of the department, administrative services and finance and policy analysis. Third page. I'm on page. They're not numbered. It's about the second to last page. And you can see we have seven positions in that program. I don't know how to describe in detail what each position does. There are about 800 positions in this program. Program support and central administration as a whole, and I actually haven't totaled the positions for central administration. 204, including of that 204, 178, I believe, are in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs.
That's correct.
Okay, so Central Health Services is the oversight. I work with the director of the department. We make sure the programs are operating as they should at a very general level and that the resources are available to them. The next office that I would bring to your attention on page two.
Just a question. What are the professional services that you purchase under central administration, central health services? Mm-hmm. Just curious.
I don't know what that is. Madam Chair, I'm going to have to provide that in writing. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Let me just walk through this document in order because this is going to be awkward if we do it otherwise. The Office of the Public Health Officer is, the administrator is Grant Higginson. Dr. Higginson is here today. He has two positions who work for him in support positions. One, in addition to doing legislative work to track the information needed to respond to the legislative session, also is our Institution Review Board Coordinator. We do a lot of research in health services, and human subjects must be protected, and there's a significant function there. And we have an office manager, Mary DeFerrari. This office reviews our policies, prepares plans to protect patients, to increase access. You've asked some questions, for example, about rural health, about the health professional shortage areas. Those functions within the department are handled here, and they work closely with the Office of Rural Health. And we do a number of things that have to do with certifying plans. For example, there's a program that makes sure that water systems are properly connected so there isn't a backflow of wastewater into public water systems, those kinds of conformities. In addition, the entire preparedness program, which includes the bioterrorism funding from the federal government and the work we're doing with the Umatilla chemical stockpile to make sure that that's properly disposed of, those are also under the supervision of Dr. Higginson. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I cannot describe in most of these in detail what professional services we're purchasing, but that information can be made available in a list to the committee. The Office of Public Health Systems is, as I described it a couple of weeks ago, is really our regulatory branch. We do a lot of licensing and regulation of hazardous materials and emergency medical services in that office. We coordinate federal, state, and local agencies in making sure drinking water is safe, that radioactive materials are handled properly. And probably the core function there has to do with sanitation and food service, which is kind of like the foundation of environmental health at the local level. And we also license hospitals, home health agencies, and in-home care, emergency medical programs. We run the trauma system and provide support for the trauma advisory committee. Now, I don't have the FTE here, but I think that Well, I know it's three, but we manage the entire office, which is a significant effort. The Office of Family Health Systems, or really Family Health Services, administers programs that we think of as maternal and child health programs, oral health, that kind of thing. This office, as you remember, Donalda Dodson described the functions of this office as spanning the entire range of functions from community-based and population-based functions all the way to delivering services to individual clients. This program contains the Women, Infants, and Children program, which is a nutrition-based program with non-limited federal funds. We have health screening, child and perinatal health, adolescent health, the baby's first program is here, and we have a significant effort in immunizations and a new oral health grant, which is going to strengthen our ability to promote oral health for Oregon's children. And there is an epidemiological component to this office, looking at data and making sure that we're responsive to changes in trends with regard particularly to child and adolescent health. The Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology is directed by Mel Cohn. Mel is a physician, and he has a couple of support specialists who work with him to manage the program at the central administration level. This program is extraordinarily diverse. It includes acute and chronic disease management. We have an environmental and occupational branch that is examining the effects of environmental toxicity and injuries in industrial settings, the collection and analysis and interpretation of health information, and this office also contains our vital statistics program, which contains birth and death records and provides other information to the public and to decision makers. Right now, that office is very much involved in tracking the epidemic that you've been hearing about, preparing for West Nile virus, which we expect to arrive here. We have a human immunodeficiency HIV program, tuberculosis, I'm on the same office, disease prevention epidemiology. HIV, sexually transmitted diseases, and tuberculosis section. There are a lot of bad things that can happen to people, and this office is watching out for them and providing a response. The Office of Medical Assistance Programs we've talked about, and there is a extensive list of functions that are provided. This office is entirely central administration, and it includes Lynn Reed and her staff who oversee the program, as well as a medical director's office. The medical director is responsible not only for medical issues, but also the transplant program, the disease management contract, and also administrative hearings when people have grievances or complaints about their access to care or the care they've received. There's a large financing operations section. They coordinate with all of the other systems we depend on to get information, process claims, get claims paid, and deal with providers as they are relating to the department for payment in health services. There's a program and policy section which analyzes our programs and is responsible for how the plan is functioning from a policy perspective. It ensures that programs operate within state and federal laws, and as you know, there are pages and pages of rules and federal requirements that must be complied with, and it is an extraordinarily complex operation. And that sort of subsumes all of the functions in a very general way, and there is a much more detailed breakout of how these staff are organized if the committee would like to have a copy of it. The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services is administered by Bob Nickel. He has several staff who help him, including Madeline Olson, who has been long with that program and is responsible really for the operations and financing and working with our contractors and so forth. They plan and develop and implement mental health and addiction services, but as we've noted on a number of occasions, the work, except for the state hospitals, is done through county mental health programs and other contractors like residential programs and day treatment programs and alcohol and drug providers, both residential and outpatient. The State Public Health Laboratory in Portland has about 75 physicians. Mike Skeels directs it. Its primary functions are to evaluate specimens for to determine if there are diseases present, to do newborn screening. They also have a major role in the emergency preparedness program in the event that there is a biological attack. For example, it is likely that that office will be the first to identify it, as they were in the late 80s with the only other episode of that kind we've had. They did a lot of the studies of white powder that was found all over the state after October of 2001. Another function of this public health laboratory is licensing other laboratories. And finally, there's my office, which I tried to describe earlier, and because I was out of sequence, I was on the wrong page here. And you have, I'm the assistant director for health services, and I have a deputy. And we have several staff who coordinate very high-level functions. One deals with information systems, which are critical to the effective functioning of our health services section. And we have administrative support for program operations, which means keeping an eye on where the money's going and coming from and that it's all in the right place, and working directly with our finance and the policy analysis section on the budget, and accounting on in administrative services. It's pretty dry stuff, if you want to know. My view of it is that our job in this central administration is to keep things compliant with rules and laws and with your direction in the budget, and to make sure that we're constantly improving what we do and reporting it accurately to policymakers and to the legislature. And I don't know, is there anything I missed?
No.
Okay. So I hope this provides some record, and as I say, there's a lot of money in program support and administration, and I think if you understand in detail what we do there, that it will become clearer why those investments have been made.
No.
Senator Carter.
Barry, I've been having some concerns since you're the associate assistant director in terms of the hepatitis A issue. It is an appropriate time to ask that question.
You can ask.
Okay, thank you. And I did see some communications that came to Senator Shields regarding this issue. As you know, last session, I passed a bill because there were problems down in Deschutes County as well as in Multnomah County. And the Center for Disease Control has targeted Oregon as the state to try to prevent an outbreak of this disease, but they say surely it's coming. And I'm wondering, number one, why are we deferring it other than money, which was stated in the letter? And number two, if some of our traditional partners are going to be working with us on this issue and can defer the cost less than $800,000, why is not wisdom allowing us to make a decision about trying to get on the upside of this issue as opposed to waiting until it gets here and then a lot of people are falling with it?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Dr. Cohn to respond. The level of detail that you're looking for, I just cannot provide.
Okay.
But I think our state epidemiologist can help me with this.
Thank you. Dr. Cohn. Did I need to rephrase that?
Madam Chair, Senator Carter, I think I understand your question, but
okay.
Let me try to answer it as best I can. And
okay.
Then if I haven't, please ask some more, and I'll
okay.
be happy to try.
Thank you.
First, let me say that we certainly share your concern about hepatitis A. Oregon is one of the states that does have higher rates of hepatitis A. We're in a trough right now in terms of our rates, and that suggests that this is a pretty good time to try to get on top of this problem. So I'm wholly supportive of that approach. I think the problem that we've run into is one of financing primarily for the vaccine. There are several streams of funding, primarily federal funding, that pay for this. And my understanding from our immunization program is that we don't have the funding to do the kind of immunization that we would like to immediately. In addition, the other concern is that it takes some time to sort of phase this in. I mean, it's not fair to say to every family, you know, tomorrow all of your children must be immunized, or we won't let them into school, for example. My understanding is it's those two concerns that have led to the timetable that was in the letter that I believe you're referring to.
I was reading Senator. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I was reading Senator Shields' letter, and I'm sure he will share in just a few minutes. But I have to tell you, Doctor, and I know you're the doctor, and we've had no reason to distrust your vision and your decisions about public health in the past, but since I do personally worry about it, since the outbreak in Deschutes County and since some of the things that's happening in Multnomah County, I believe it's so important to move forward with a school entry requirement, if necessary, to protect Oregon students from this disease. And I think that unless we can get started on, like you said, while we're in this trough, on the upside of it, that it's going to cost us more in the long run. So I do have real concerns about that.
Thank you, Senator.
Yeah, did you want to have a comment, Senator Shields?
As you know, you wrote the letter to me originally, and I know that I had asked Enolda Dodson about it when she was in front of us. And the thing that occurs to me is that if we keep looking, we may be able to find ways to reduce the cost that you're concerned about. The cost that has been mentioned several times could be significantly less if we do some creative thinking and if we do some... And I'm not, Madam Chair, I'm not blowing smoke when I say this. I think there are ways that the cost could be significantly less, and I have some ideas, and I'd be glad to talk to you about them at some point in the future. Okay?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, we would be very happy to do that. I think, you know, again, the end goal, we're all on the same page about the end goal here, so there's no doubt about that. And if you have some ideas and we can make them work, absolutely, we'd love to do it.
Thank you. Barry, just a quick question on your central administration overview. Just wanted to know what happened to Katie and... because I see in the old box, the old organization chart, you have seven positions within the Central Health Services Office, and then under that you have the Deputy Sue, and then you have Intergovernmental Relations, which is Katie, and I know where Program Operation is, but I haven't found Katie, so I don't want to miss Ms. Rosette.
You know, Madam Chair... we've been paying Katie, so I think we'll have to find a place for her on this organizational table. And I think it may be our error. I'm not sure I know which budget line.
I understood it out today, and I didn't see it in the organizational structure. See you, Malcolm. I didn't see it.
Madam Chair.
Maybe Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
305, remember, right?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shields.
If you're looking at all these boxes and stuff and the charts and stuff, just remember, Katie has never been boxed in.
That's pretty good, Senator Carter.
While you are stopping at this point, I just want to also welcome to this department our former colleague and dear friend of mine, Gail Shibley, who came back from Washington, D.C., and he's with us, and so we like...
Are you sure she's in the box?
I know.
Nobody puts her in the box.
That's Gail, you know.
But that was an observation of mine when I looked over the old chart versus what you presented to us this morning. So I'm certain we'll probably have some update on the organizational structure.
Madam Chair, thank you. I must say that the degree of detail of your understanding about our organization is reassuring to me, and I will find out where Katie is and make sure that she stays there.
Madam Chair, amidst all the fun, can I just enter into our records just a fragment of comments from the American Liver Foundation, if you don't mind?
Well, I'd like for him to get through his thing.
Get through his thing?
Yeah, and then you can do it at the end.
At the end.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Because I don't want to break his train of thought.
No, we don't want Barry to have to be frazzled.
Yes. I think we're... Senator Morris.
May I ask another question?
You may. You certainly may.
Thank you. What is included in personal services?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, you mean in the categories of...
What would be the expenses included in that summary personal services?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, salary and benefits for the people who are employed by the department. Are there additional salary and benefits?
Thank you.
Any further questions? Follow up?
I'll visit with you later.
Pardon? I asked for a detail on some of that. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Madam Chair, we have responses to questions that have been posed, and there were many.
Colleagues, that's this document here.
This document relates to the Office of Medical Mental Health and Addictions Services. We will have a similar package for public health and a similar package for the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. We chose to present the budget thematically in that way because it makes it, I think, legible and it, in categories that are understandable to you and to the public. But I don't, lest there be any misunderstanding here, we do, there are a number of things we do that are very, very integrated. We, for example, mental health is working closely with Mel Cohn's office around suicide prevention. It's a logical alliance. But for the purpose of responding to your questions, we wanted to package this so that we could do that. There are a lot of questions answered here. The table of contents will direct you to them. In each case, we've identified who asked the question and what it was. And rather than spend the rest of our hour and 10 minutes on each of these questions, I wanted to focus on the things that you made clear were of greatest importance to the committee. And we're going to begin. I've asked Bob Nickel, who's here with me, to talk about a concern that was raised in the 2001 session in which we have brought forward and about which a lot of work has been done, and that is how we understand our performance and outcome and how we report that. And in specifically, Madam Chair, you asked for a county-by-county display of that, and we've provided that for you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cordley.
Thank you. And before you go further, Mr. Cast, I had also asked a question early in these hearings about the department's position on Senate Bill 18. You'll recall that is the legislation that deals with investigations of abuse of the mentally ill and disabled, and I don't see a reference to that in the table of comments, and I've just scanned the materials, so I need to hear back on that. I'd like to hear something today.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, it's not in this package because we provided a response the first week of our testimony in writing to the committee, and I will provide additional copies if that's been...
I've not seen that response.
Mr. Britton, would you make sure that sure. response gets distributed to the members? Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, Acting Administrator of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. As Barry mentioned, if you'll turn to page 8 in this rather large document, you'll see the display county by county of the outcome improvement report. And this is for the latest quarter that we have results. And you can see the lines across the top, engaged, retained in services, completed, and reduced use. And the totals are at the bottom. And we've also displayed, I think in the pages before that, if I remember how we did this, some of the more detail about the measures themselves, why they're important, a couple of years back in terms of what our goals have been, so you get a little bit of a trend.
Well,
we on page.
Excuse me a moment. Could you just walk us through when you say engaged? I mean, does that mean that we're going to get married? Give me
Madam Chair, if you look at page one, we've reproduced a, not to to make a play on words, but the alcohol and drug treatment performance model is there, and that shows the goal that we have, the high level outcomes, example, percent of clients who reduce their use of public supported services, percent of clients exiting treatment who are employed. And then below that are the intermediate level outcomes, which contribute to high level outcomes and then eventually will achieve, or at least contribute toward the achievement of the goal. So percent of engaged clients are those who are retained in treatment 90 days or more. I think I may have mentioned in my earlier testimony that that's in the research literature one of the benchmarks for whether people are going to be successful in treatment is whether they stay in treatment for a period of at least 90 days. If they stay in treatment less than that, the results tend to be less successful. Not that some people can't be successful in treatment in shorter periods of time, but generally speaking, that's the period of time that's needed.
Yeah, I raise that because often, you know, we know what we're talking about, but, you know, those of us here on this panel sometimes, 101 is a good thing because, you know, we use terminology and so it just helps us have a clearer understanding of what you're talking about when you say engaged and how long is retention. And it might be just a nice little thing to would have been to bracket it underneath the little category. But go right ahead.
Page two has the same sort of material, but in a little bit different format, and actually has some more narrative that helps answer some of the questions you're asking and raising.
Just one point to be made here is that the model that we're using, and after last session, it was very clear that the issue of measurement was important to the future evaluation of all of these programs, not just in health, but across the department. The model is one that says, what are we trying to accomplish and what are the steps to understanding whether we've been successful? High-level outcomes are outcomes that we're striving to achieve but can't take full credit for. For example, having a better society is part of mental health and addictions treatment is part of that, but we can't take responsibility for everything there. Intermediate-level outcomes, however, are performance measures that relate directly to what we do. And we want to report clearly that the benchmark level, which is the very highest level, is something we contribute to and we want to track and participate in and measure. But what we're really looking at is how we're doing, and that's the level that we think the detail needs to be focused.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. From the layman's perspective, looking at the summary on page 8, I guess maybe explain what is meant by reduced use, because my perception is that if you're an alcoholic or a drug addict, there's no gray. You're either recovering and dealing with it, or you're using. What is meant by that classification?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I think it's a really good question. There are theories that are called harm reduction, and I couldn't agree more with you that for most people who have real addiction problems, reduced use usually means they're relapsing. And so the data that we've collected here probably could use some additional refinement, and I think what we're trying to get away from really is the usual measures is just how many people did we serve, and I think we're moving in the right direction by, again, pointing out how many people are reporting either no use, which I think is always the ideal, or at least reduced use. Now, there are probably some people who, for whom reducing their usage is a good step in the right direction. But as I said before, my own experience as an alcohol and drug counselor leads me to the same conclusion that you have, I think, and that is that what we really need to be shooting for here is abstinence.
Well, I see we have a goal or a measurement. The percentage of clients who complete treatment and are not abusing drugs, which I assume would fall in the category that we're agreeing on. Are we measuring that now, or is that something yet to be measured?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, yes, we are measuring that now. We're in October. We're going to begin getting more precise about the urinalysis and the tests that we are able to do for those clients for whom it's legal for us to do them. In other words, we can't force somebody who's in on a voluntary basis to require them to do a urinalysis, although it's often a very good therapeutic and treatment tool. But we're going to be, in October of this year, using as our benchmark their last urinalysis before they leave treatment. And that will give us, I think, a more definitive answer to whether people have really stopped using or abusing drugs.
You want a follow-up question?
Please. So we don't have that data now. It's something that will be evolving.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, we do have data now, but it's not as refined as that. I mean, we do ask people, are you using less or have you used in the last 30 days? But we need to be more systematic about that. And I think that was one of the issues that was raised last session about improving our ability to monitor what people are really doing and not rely solely on self-report. And if we do rely on self-report, make sure that we're asking those questions in an educated, sophisticated way so that we get more reliable data.
If I heard you correctly, I think it raises an interesting policy question, and that is, I believe you said we cannot require a urinalysis. Well, my point to that would be, if you can't require a urinalysis, we'll never know how to determine that measurement of recovery.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, we've gotten some advice from the Department of Justice in the past biennium that we would be potentially treading on people's constitutional rights if we required them to turn in a urinalysis if they're not in mandated treatment. If they're in mandated treatment, and probably 60% or more of people are in mandated treatment, we can require urinalysis there, and we do that. I think the research is fairly clear that even self-report can be a reliable indicator, sometimes as reliable as urinalysis if it's done in an educated, sophisticated way. Urinalysis can be misleading as well if the urinalysis is done outside. Sometimes there are narrow windows of opportunity in terms of time and when a urinalysis will show positive. In other words, if I had ingested marijuana in the last 30 days at any quantity, that stays in my system longer. However, if it's methamphetamines, it's out in a couple of days. Alcohol is out in a matter of 9 hours. So your analysis, depending on the substance that's ingested, can be more or less helpful, but it really does depend on the period of time after ingestion that you actually perform the urinalysis. I don't know if that helps answer some of the questions.
Madam Chair, it would seem to me that for the voluntary service, that as a condition of providing that service, that there would be certain protocols that could be required without being illegal. And I'm wondering if that's something that is a policy issue that would be helpful, and this would have to come as a recommendation from you, I believe. To add strength to the program.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, in the world out there, it is often a very good treatment tool to persuade the person to, even if they're in on a voluntary basis, to use a urinalysis as a way of helping them monitor themselves, help themselves be honest about what they're doing. I've used that many times during the time when I was in practice. As far as whether we should look at a policy in that area, I think that is a good question, and we're certainly willing to take that back and take a look at it.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I want to draw your attention to the testimony earlier that we responded to a budget note that I think Representative Bates was very interested in, relating to the whole issue of urinalysis and verification. And we did work with an independent research firm and with the Attorney General to come forward with a plan, and that plan will be piloted and moved forward in the future to strengthen the confidence that you can have in the data that we provide. Some of these issues are policy questions like the one you just asked that I think deserve further attention, and we'll do that. I don't know that members have a copy of that e-board report, but we can certainly provide that to staff.
Just go back a little bit to your attachment A, the county by county summary. And I think it would be helpful because in order for you to have your statewide goal performance measures outcomes, that you would have collected that data from the county. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct. We collect this information.
In order to be consistent, it would be very helpful if you knew what the success rates were within those counties.
Madam Chair, we are, and we didn't have this available in this format, but we are now being able to look by provider to see how effective various providers are. The one caveat to that is some providers serve people who have relatively more severe addiction issues than others. For example, there's a very good program in Klamath Falls that serves only people who have been in a great deal of legal difficulty, and it's a very different sort of environment. I've been there. I've seen this. Their success rates are probably going to be a little bit less than programs that serve people who haven't had quite as much legal involvement. So when we compare providers to providers, we do want to make sure that we're making that a fair comparison.
I can accept that, but I think part of our discussion last session was when we talked about performance measures, we talked about performance measures from having it prescriptive within the contracts of the providers, and so that we're collecting the information, and you can always make a footnote where you have different kinds of population, but I think this body was trying to get everyone in the habit of dealing with outcomes at all levels, and the only way I knew how to do it was to say that when you're contracting with a provider, that they too will be held at the same standards that this body's going to hold you to, and with that means that your contracts then, in your contract language, is the requirement of, I think, some of these performance measures. And you can always footnote that if you've got a particular provider who is taking more difficult cases, you know, you could highlight those. But certainly, I think for consistency's sake, I personally would like to see the goals from statewide of where we are. You know, we had a lot of discussion last session about what program was working over in Central Oregon and what wasn't working down in Southern Oregon. And it just gives us some better refinement tools, I think, when we're going through these budgets every 2 years.
Madam Chair, I want to repeat, too, that we are now moving toward five counties are involved with us in piloting outcome-based, performance-based contracts, and we are moving in that direction with those five counties this coming biennium, and we'll continue to move in that direction.
Would you give me the five counties that you're working with for outcome-based, and then also give me a plan for how we're going to move towards all 36 counties to be on board?
I'm sure we can do that.
And I think it's very critical in an environment where we're talking about limited resources these are some of the tools that help us to make some, decisions. Excuse me. Senator Yee, if you're listening.
Madam Chair, should we move on to another?
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Just to make the point that those same approaches to measurement are being applied not only to substance abuse but also to mental health outcomes and performance indicators.
I believe that it was put in every, I know from my committees, my agencies, that I think all of them were budget noted to make certain. And I believe also that not just the Human Services Committee, but I know that other chairs are making the same requirements. It's something that we believe is long overdue.
Madam Chair, a second area of concern that you expressed related to the mental health organizations and their carryover reserves. And if you turn to page 41 of the document, we have provided a copy of the material we provided to the emergency board. Here it is. August 26th is the date of that report, and we have updated the report to include eight consecutive quarters. And one of the page 41.
It's actually
page 43. I see there is an intentionally blank page on page 42. Page 43 is the text of the report we made to the emergency board in August, or I guess it was actually in September. And then you asked us to update the financial reports from each of the mental health organizations, and we've done that. The latest month or the latest quarter for which we have complete data is the quarter ending September 30th, 2002. And I want to make one additional point, and that was that one concern that was raised in this evaluation, which was prompted in part by Senator Messerly's concerns brought forward, was that we did not have a consistent format for organizations to report to us, and that problem has been corrected. And we have confidence that these numbers are reasonably comparable so that you can get the information you need for decision making. Now, in terms of the content, did you want to make any comment? In terms of the content of the report, one of the issues concerned a couple of organizations which had unexpectedly large reserves, and we set a standard of 90 days operating capital as a threshold. And I think you can see from this report that consistently the average for these organizations is a little over a month of operating capital, which in a risk-based environment is probably less than sufficient. One point to make here is that our contracts with each of these organizations require a minimum reserve account, I believe, of $250,000. In a couple of cases, there are large reserves, and we anticipate that as in this particular financial environment, that those reserves are being used to buffer the effects of the reductions in the budget that we've been experiencing since last fall. Mr. Nichols reminding me that the trend is consistently down in these reserves, and partly that's the Hawthorne.
50.
Pardon me? Page. Yes, page 50. And over those eight quarters, the trend is down. I suspect that some of that has to do with the financial condition of the mental health organizations, and some of it may have to do with the Hawthorne effect of actually looking at an issue and provoking people to practices mm-hmm. that are more conform to our expectations.
Mm-hmm. We were looking at Clackamas County, and there was huge correction.
I was looking at that, too. What page are you on, Madam Chair?
Well, if you start on page 47,
I did, yes.
Clackamas County had a 3.7, almost 3.8. And then you have a correction if you look at page 50. in June 30th, they had a 1.4 correction. So something happened.
Exactly.
What?
And that was what Reverend Smith, Greg Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I'm going to ask a bizarre question, but I'm just brainstorming here, so if that's all right. As we're going through the budgetary process, or as we've been through the budgetary process, we've made a lot of reductions in funding to a lot of our partners out there, primarily nonprofits. Is there any type of coordination, teamwork, to where we're saying, okay, what can we do to assist these nonprofits that are not cash-related but still help them with their efficiencies in their operation? And let me tell you what I'm thinking about. I know in my district we have state office buildings that have additional space, and space is going vacant even though it's being heated and electricity's being put in there, and yet our nonprofits who are receiving now less money are still having to cover their lease payments and their rent payments and their utility payments. Is there any type of coordination to help these nonprofits out, even though we can't send them more money? But are there alternative ways to assist? And again, Madam Chair, I'm just brainstorming.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, at the state level, I'm not aware of any systematic approach to that. It's a very interesting idea. I'm sure at the local level there are those kinds of discussions, but I think one of the roles of the state is to check on those kind of things and facilitate it and be helpful. So I think your suggestion is well taken, and we'll take it back.
Just as a follow-up, I just think there's a tremendous opportunity for us to look at alternative ways to assist our partners, even if it's not in the form of a direct check, because a lot of times just by reducing an expense, they can free up other money then to reach out and assist the folks we're trying to reach. So I'd hope you would look into that.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, thank you. We did respond to your question about provider layoffs, and we provided on page 25 the data from the survey that we did that demonstrates that based on an 80% response rate, we expect that about 1,800 staff will have been laid off in community programs as a result of the changes in the budget by the end of this biennium. And we do everything we can. We've pursued issues of co-location and so forth, but the extent of change that's happening out there is something that we need to understand better. It is a substantial change in the capacity of the mental health service system at the local
level.
Just
one quick follow-up, Chair.
Thank Representative you. Smith.
Again, one observation I have in the area I represent, and it's a large rural area, is I can go to a meeting and I will have three vehicles representing local, county, and state government all driving to that meeting, and to me it just seems like there could be a tremendous coordination to where perhaps the state drives and the county and the city go with them and the nonprofit goes with them and some dollars could be saved. And granted, we're talking pennies, but if you don't watch your pennies, the dollars tend to get away from you. And I really think the state needs to be looking at those type of partnerships to figure out how to create those synergies.
Yeah. Madam Chair, before I talk about cultural competence, I do want to. There was one thing, and this document has been worked on even today to make some revisions. And I did catch one thing that I was a little concerned about on page 55. The question was, how many acute care beds do we purchase, and what's the actual use of those beds? The thing that I'm a little concerned about was that it seems to imply that the remaining number of 26,000 bed days were purchased by the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And it's actually a little more complicated than that. There are a variety of funding sources. It's true that the department, through the Office of Mental Health Services staff, has negotiated some contracts with either local county mental health programs and directly with a couple of hospital systems in Portland, but it's not the full 78 bed days. And if you begin to go through our budget very carefully, I think you would have a hard time seeing where we're buying 78 beds unless the price was so ridiculously low no one would sell them to us for that. So I made a list of the other purchasers for those kinds of beds, and the counties do purchase some beds. ORS 426 requires counties to buy any beds for hold patients if they're not otherwise funded. There is third-party insurance that sometimes will purchase a bed for a person even though they've come in through the public mental health system. Medicare purchases some. And frankly, hospitals have a certain amount of uncompensated care for some of the psychiatric inpatient beds. So I just want to make a clarification to page 55. And I apologize for that not being clear when we finished this document this morning. Page 57, cultural competence. We have been working with a variety of people around a cultural competency performance outcome model, and it's very similar to the performance model that we looked at a little bit earlier when we began the discussion about performance objectives. And so, again, as Barry mentioned, we have a goal which in this case, we probably have more control over that than some of the other broad-based goals. We have a high-level income of increasing the percent of people from racial ethnic groups with improved behavioral health functioning, and then intermediate-level outcomes, as you can see in the chart on page 57. We've also broken that down into more detail on the following pages, 58. We're describing measures like cultural competency training, and we have a description of the goal that we're working for there, why it's important, and sources of data. So we wanted to share this because we really did not talk very much in our 3 days before you earlier about some of the issues we're working on in the area of cultural competence. I also am beginning to ask regularly that as we put together our data reports, for example, we have a data report coming out on our extended care and enhanced care programs, that we always break that down by racial ethnicity groups so that we have a better idea of how we're doing. And I think that we just need to make that more of a routine than we maybe have done in the past.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Looking at the cultural competency performance outcome model, what strikes me about the model, at least in the way that it's represented here, is that it appears to be focused externally. And by that I mean I don't see references that would tell me or tell us that you're measuring your performance, you're measuring the performance of the organization, the internal performance of the organization. Changes in the culture, changes mm-hmm. in the training and orientation of the folks who make up the governmental organization.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think it's a good point, and I think this is still something that we're developing. It really doesn't get at some of the internal culture issues, which I think is most of us who've worked with this for a while realize that you have to get at the core at some point. It can't be all external measurements. So I think we need to take that back and take the question back and work with this some more.
And when you say take it back, thank you, Madam Chair. When you say take it back, what does that mean? Take it back to whom and to what process? We've been at this for a while, at least in terms of discussion. And so I'm looking for some more meat.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, thank you. In terms of internal processes to the health services cluster, we have the Office of Multicultural Health, and we have been working with them on this process. But beyond that, I think if I understand the question clearly, we also need to make sure we include people of color, consumers, family members, providers, et cetera, as we also refine these things. And at this point, I'm not sure to what degree we've reached outside the department for those kind of things, and I think it's a point we will take back and do something with.
Maybe I can follow up for you. I think that what the good senator is, the question that she's asking, when you say take back, what do you mean take back? Is it something that you're going to discuss at the central level with Barry? And or is it with a broader base with other employees? Just what is the take back? I think that's. Am I trying to get there?
That's very clear, Madam Chair. Just a restatement of what I'm asking.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I think by take back I would mean all of those levels. We will talk with Barry. We'll talk with the multicultural office. We'll work with our own staff, and we'll involve other people who can help us with this process.
I just need to kind of state for the record, not only for your agency, but it has always bothered me that we have to set up a separate entity in order to address issues that should be addressed ongoing as a part of process of government. I mean, to have to say that we have to have, and I support Vicki, and I've known her for years, but it's very troublesome to think in terms that you have to direct government or agencies to do what they should be doing automatically, and being all inclusive. And I think that's what Senator Gordley and I found it very disconcerting to return back after being away from this building for 20 years to come back and to think that we're still addressing those kinds of issues. And they're not going to go away. And at some point, we're going to have to deal with the reality that people, regardless of who, what, color, shape, form, that they all be along a part of our process. And I think that's for those of us who really strive to make sure that we, this government in the state of Oregon, I can't speak for another state, that we truly do become colorblind, that we truly do become where we're going to include everyone regardless of where they come from, is a goal that I seek. And I would hope that every administrator who works in this state would have the similar kind of goals and concerns, because that's the only way we're going to change the fabric and the climate here in this mm-hmm. state. And it's through working together. I told somebody it's kind of interesting. It's not enough just to look on the TV to see people of different ethnic backgrounds in our case. It's when you leave school and you have to work side by side with folks. So I think that's what the good senator is talking about when she says, take it back where, and what kinds of things are you going to do. And it's beyond just talking about multicultural, that it's easy to shift it all over to Vicki, and I don't think that that's satisfactory for me.
Madam Chair, I think the overarching issue is this. Do we currently employ, and that is not to say a word that is disparaging or demeaning about any of the people who are in this room, but do we currently have the capacity and the expertise that will get us to where we need to go? That's mm-hmm. what I'm questioning. I don't believe that we do. And so, you know, that's something that will take continued discussions and deliberations through the organization and with the assistance of this legislative body. The model can't change until we have people who have the expertise and the capacity to help us look at the change. And that's our challenge, and that's also our opportunity. And I also believe that Mr. Cast and Mr. Nickel, you know, on a number of levels, they understand that and are committed to that, but I think they're going to need help getting to the next level.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I would not disagree with anything you've said. Those of us who are struggling with these issues are also in these issues and have the same development in this society that we've all had, and we're wrestling constantly with diversity and cultural relevance and cultural competence and learning. I wanted to point out, because it was sent under separate cover, that Dr. Mazurhart has responded to Senator Gordley's questions about the action plan at Oregon State Hospital to bring about improvement in this area. One of the features of that plan is an external review process that helps us look at ourselves by engaging people who aren't a part of our organizations. That came under separate cover to the committee, and I don't want, lest it be missed, I thought I would bring it to your attention.
And Madam
we're
Chair,
gonna,
that document I didn't
you
receive. Did,
you did receive it. And we're going to be receiving other documents today. They're hot on the press and probably en route. Oh, he has them.
Madam Chair, there's a ton of information here, and I'm sure once you've examined it, you'll have other questions, but there are some issues in public health and at OMAP that you wanted us to address, and maybe this would be a time to do that. It's your discretion.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I don't want to leave the conversation we've just had. I guess I'm struggling with the fact that we're using comments such as we're struggling to get there. I guess I want to hear from you folks soon as to what it's going to take to get there. If we've got a group of members up here who are saying this is pretty darn important to us, and I speak for myself here, I don't feel comfortable knowing that I'm going to vote on a budget knowing that I walked away hearing, well, we're struggling to get there. I want to leave here knowing that there's an action plan in place, so when we come back here, hopefully 2 years from now, that we can look at this and say we are there.
I'll respond for a minute. I don't want to put you on the spot, and I'm sure that the three of us do not either. This systemic issue is not one that's unique to this agency. It's an issue that is bound in years and years of I call it benign neglect. And it's not just the members here. It's a societal thing, and it's an issue to train and educate other people. It's a talk about how it's belief systems. It's just a whole lot of things, and agencies also struggle with how do you implement all of this. And I don't want to put all the burden on my good panel here, because I think collectively it takes all of us. I think it just not only takes the state agencies. I think it takes us as legislators. I think it takes us talking to our neighbors next door. Mm-hmm. I think this is really a fundamental, basic premise that, you know, hopefully one of these days we all will truly walk hand in hand and glove in glove. So I don't want to put it there. And I know the agencies, some of them, you know, really try. But you have, you have to wait till systems sometimes change, particularly employees turnover. There's just a whole myriad of stuff that gets involved in government. But the challenge is, to me, that it stays there in the forefront and that we're conscious of it as we're going about our daily business and recognizing that when we're talking to our employees or when we've got the opportunity to do so, that we address it through those little openings that come up from time to time. Mm-hmm. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Just a final comment, and then I'll move on. I just want folks within your department to know when I tour your facilities during the interim, which I've done in the past and will do again, I will be asking the staff these questions and what steps they're taking to move in this direction. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative, we would welcome that.
Terrible cold today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Mr. Britt, I want to apologize for the amount of paper and the way in which it's packaged, but we went to the final hour. However, the next segment.
Well, Barry, I have to say I want to commend you for getting all this ready and having it available for us today. Somebody tells me that somebody's been up, working to churn out these documents. So
please don't apologize.
I don't apologize.
Madam Chair, apparently we were editing these on our lunch hour.
So. Hey, you just got a kudu. Now we know why your overhead's so high.
All these legislators asking these questions.
There is a document entitled, it isn't entitled, it just says April 2nd to 8th on it. This is the response of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and Lynn Reed's here to talk about it. I'd like to pursue the baby.
Okay. I'm Lynn Reed, administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And I was up at 3 a.m. editing this document. Since we were last in the presentation, the questions came to us with a short turnaround. And Barry had just indicated that he'd like to talk about the Babies First program, so I'll let you do that one first.
Well, why don't you describe how the money moves to the content.
As I understood it, when the public health portion of health services was up, there were some questions that were related to how the funding for Babies First works. And in the public health portion of our budget, there is $1,066,136 identified for Babies First. And that funding ultimately goes to the counties that deliver that service. The counties add additional funding to the money they receive from the department. They, in turn, will provide services and bill us in OMAP, and we'll make payment to the counties. And when we do that, we have a combination of other funds and federal funds. The whole purpose here of using OMAP in this process is to be able to draw down some federal funds. So the counties send us $2.6 million in payment ultimately from their sources, and we draw down federal funds of $3.9 million and turn around and pay the counties the $6.4 million. The actual process of how that works is in a flow chart that I believe is the document Barry wanted to explain.
This document, which is entitled Babies First and Healthy Start, which responds to your questions about how the two programs work together. About the fifth page in is a diagram which shows you how the money moves around. Again, I don't know.
I can do it if you want.
I want to make, before Lynn explains this, let me point out that this mechanism, which is funded under a Medicaid option called targeted case management, is a similar to a mechanism that the local commissions have used in the Healthy Start program for administrative matching, which is done in a similar way.
Mm-hmm.
And the vehicle for making this work is the Office of Medical Assistance Programs and our relationship with the Center
Healthy
for Medicaid.
Start running through there too?
Yes.
Yes.
So using this diagram in Attachment A, the local health department receives Babies First money, general fund dollars, from the public health portion of our department. They receive money from the counties and general fund dollars that they use from within their county. And they also have other revenue sources that they can devote to this effort. They, in turn, provide, the local health department provides a service to families. Then if you move over to the first arrow, number one, in that series of arrows, the local health department will send a bill to OMAP. We, in turn, for the service they provided to the family, we, in turn, will turn around a payment to that local health department, which is the second arrow. We pay for that targeted case management service. We also, shortly thereafter, bill the county for the state fund component of that service, which is, and they, in item number four, pay us that state fund component, and that's the money that they got over there in the left-hand boxes. They use that to pay us back. The end result is that we have drawn down federal funds and enhanced the money that came in at the front end. So that for the 40 cents that came in on the front end, we drew down 60 cents federal dollars. And so there was, a dollar spent for 40 cents of state dollars.
That's why we call it leveraging that.
Well, the wash machine pop process.
And this is acknowledged and known by the federal government as an appropriate use of funds.
Discussion out at this end, and the washing machine analogy did come up. It's rather complicated.
What did you put?
This is legal.
Yes. No one told us who the group was coming in that came and visited us. Welcome. And
Madam Chair, this process of leveraging is what Linda Fleming yesterday referred to as end-loading. If the legislature so wished, we could put the general fund dollars up front, but we'd have to spend more out of the general fund. This way, counties can use local fees, local tax revenues, and can boost the effort that they can make. In any case, the value of service is the full value.
Yeah, I like clean clothes. I just have a question, Lynn. Does the targeted case management have to be statewide?
Madam Chair, targeted case management actually can be targeted to specific geographic areas. It does not have to be statewide.
So, my little wheels just turning up here. That's why I asked the question. Because we're doing it for Healthy Start and we're doing it for Babies First, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, we've provided a table, the previous page, which at your request displays the 0305 budget for each county and how much general fund under the Babies First program will be flowing there. I can't describe under Healthy Start. That's the State Commission on Children and Families.
We'll get that from them.
We did work with them to provide a description of how these two programs work together. They use very different models and have different targeted populations. And this blended model is one that the legislature has directed us to use and which is now in place. There is, I think, a compatibility or complementarity to the program. They do differ in some respects. In many of the counties, both Healthy Start and Babies First are operated through local health departments, and they're actually the same staff who are doing managing both. So that's a description as you had requested.
Are we getting the same 60-40 match with both?
Madam Chair, the Healthy Start program uses a vehicle for administrative matching, and I think that's 50-50
that's
match.
Correct. 50-50.
And the difference there has to do with the requirements for clinical intervention and so forth. I'm sure it's a very complicated set of federal rules. One of the requirements that we make is that they must be able to clearly distinguish on a time study whether you're doing this activity or that activity so that there is no possibility of a federal exception on an audit, and we're very careful about that.
Okay.
And as Barry had mentioned earlier in the administrative budget discussion, about 50% of our administrative budget is the result of doing this type of it's the leveraging the pass-through dollars that move through our budget. As opposed to having staff to actually do that, we try to absorb that workload.
So you absorb this function within inside your...
Right.
I think, let me just clarify, because I think that the $6,400,000 that's described here would pass through as a leverage, would have shown up as an administrative cost to the department, even though this is program dollars that are supporting program, just as the payments to fully capitated health plans or mental health organizations are. And that's why we spent so much time at the beginning talking about that administrative budget
that
and how it needs to be restated.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was asking that question because the overhead management said,
There's two pieces. There's the $58 million that somehow got stuck into their administrative piece, which shouldn't have because it's actual pass-through.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Smith, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Chairwinners. Two questions, and I'm trying to get a little 101 here. If a county decided that these type of services were a high priority and chose to put additional money in, would they be able to leverage additional money to come back to the county through this model?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, that is one of the advantages of a targeted case management approach is that if there are funds available that are permissible to use for this purpose, meaning they're not already federal funds that have flown into flowed into the county. They could do that if the service that they're providing is a service that we cover, that's a Medicaid coverable service, and indeed they could enhance the range of services they provide in that fashion.
Follow up. So let's say you had a county with a health district. Could the health district funnel that money through the county, through this process, enhance the leverage with a greater return back through to the county, so long as they were providing the services within this range?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, yes, that's correct.
Okay. One last question. I just want to make sure I understand this. Under other non-federal revenue sources, I see a dollar sign. In any way, can a county use in-kind, or must it be cash?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, start to move outside my limited knowledge base on this. There is the ability for governmental entities provide an in-kind, meaning they provide a service. We use the value of that service as the state component and draw down federal funds. That's how the in-kind process works, and it's limited to who can do it. And we'd need to bring in someone who is an expert on that type of leveraging, perhaps Jerry Fuller from the finance office.
Just quick, sorry. To me, it just seems like there's a potential. Again, I know nothing.
I have to interject some pieces, because some of the issues inside of their budgets is maintenance of effort issue, and I know you kind of cautious of tipping around what is in kind of where it came from, because you don't want to get yourself in trouble with those pieces too. Although I think that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. All I was thinking about is there's a chance to get some more money from the federal government into some of our clinics, and we could be creative in doing it. I encourage that. That's where I was going.
Thank you.
Mr. Britton.
And I think, Representative Smith, that Lynn indicated at least one person, and I know there are more because I talk to them all the time, who are really good, and I would expect the department is open to those kinds of ideas. But Mr. Fuller is somebody that does that a lot with the school districts, and there are others, I would assume, as well. Right, Lynn?
Yes, there are.
Just one last quick question, Chair.
Representative Smith.
Is there any way of not letting this thought drop here today, but trying to reach out to the folks who are running these clinics and try and pool what we're talking about to help them? Because you've got a lot of folks out there running a lot of clinics who are good intent or well-intentioned, big-hearted folks who don't have the technical expertise to know that this may be an option to them. And somehow it seems like we need to reach out to them and say there is technical assistance available to help you do this. Because $5,000 in some of these clinics means the difference between paying the bills and not getting them paid.
One of the things that has occurred, I know that we've been working with Gina Furman, who has posed the same question, and to try to assure that we are maximizing all of the, quote, dollars out there, quote, unquote, whether it is county sourced or whether it is nonprofits, to be certain that in Oregon we're leveraging every place that we can leverage. And we've had a number of meetings and discussions, and the county has been collecting information for us in order to try to make certain that we are doing that. And I know that they've been meeting across the state with I know all 36 counties that are having input into this particular issue. Senator Morris.
Thank you. The Department of Administrative Services is bringing in a consultant that specializes just exclusively in how to maximize the federal dollars.
Yeah.
So I think we're doing that. Now, how that would cascade down to the local counties would be a good question, I think, probably to follow up with DAS. Madam Chair, is this simply a program of loaning the money to the counties and then park it long enough to get the federal dollars and then repaid back?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't know that I would describe it that way. In order to, it's a service that's provided that is a Medicaid-eligible service provided to Medicaid clients. And in order to draw federal dollars into your program, there's a requirement, for the most part, that the state supply, based on the match rate for Oregon, 40% of the funding, and that the federal government will provide 60% of the funding. And in this particular program, because we're utilizing local government we're able to make the state portion of the funding come from that local government source as opposed to the state general fund. So it's just an identification of who is eligible and willing to put forward the state portion of the funding.
Follow up. The 40 cents in this case on the flow chart here, the bill state match, we bill them. And then they turn around and pay us back. Is that a loan of sorts?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't think it has to. would necessarily have to be handled that way. It would be possible probably for somehow within, you know, I'm not expert at all on this, for that 40 cents to come into our budget to begin with, and then there wouldn't be any necessity to come back and request that funding. The reason I think it's done in this particular fashion is that that allows the local health department to decide how much of its revenue it wants to put to this particular function, whereas if they moved all the revenue to us, we'd be deciding for them how much of their revenue was going to this function.
And Madam Chair, Senator Morse, limiting the program, in this case the program is Babies First, and we don't want to limit that program solely to Medicaid-eligible individuals. It's an early childhood professional intervention program targeted on certain kids at very high risk, not all of whom are eligible for Medicaid. So what it's sort of like what came first. The program came first, and then we identified with the counties a way to amplify that revenue and take advantage of the fact that we were serving Medicaid-eligible children and should get that federal portion. So this is a more flexible and locally oriented way of doing business. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Madam Chair, I know we do have we're approaching 3 o'clock, and I don't want to spend time talking about items that may not be of the greatest interest to you. I think I would highlight one of the charts that we provided, which is attachment E. One of the questions you had asked was, how are the dollars distributed in our budget among the various eligibility categories? And attachment E shows for the 2001-03, our current authority, a budget, where we're spending our dollars. These are total fund dollars. And so you can see that the largest expenditures are going to the aid to the blind, aid to the disabled category. The next largest group is the OHP standard adults couples group, and that's a group that has a significant number of individuals with high medical needs. Then I would jump over to the TANF column, the temporary assistance to needy families. At the low end, you see poverty level medical children above the poverty level at 48.1 million children are pretty inexpensive. The general assistance population was at 60.3 million. That's a fairly expensive population, but a very few people that were in that category. You can move over to the far right and see the Children's Health Insurance Program at 39.1 million. These are biennial numbers. So it's quite different kinds of expenditures and needs among the various eligibility groups. Beyond that, I think most of the information here has some narrative around it, and we'll be glad to answer questions after you've had a chance to review the information. There are a couple of questions that we weren't able to pull the information together all together for you, because that information is coming from other parts of the department, and we have referred on a request for that additional information.
I would like to thank you for your comprehensive package, and you've done a very good job of getting all these questions answered and getting them back to us. And I would really encourage the members to read the material. And if you have further questions, then we can submit them to you and get them back in writing. And Mr. Britt and I would, if you would follow up on us. Senator Gordley's request to make sure that there's copies of that, and again, I would like to thank you for your 101. It was very well done, and I need to read for the record for Senator Carter. She had to leave, but she wanted me to read this in for the record, and it's from the American Liver Foundation. And to Senator Carter and Senator Scheel, and it says, The American Liver Foundation, a Pacific Northwest chapter, urged you to support efforts by the Department of Human Services to implement a school vaccine requirement for hepatitis A in Oregon. Hepatitis A is a disease of the liver that is fully preventable by vaccination. The disease kills more than 100 people annually, and while not serious for children, is very serious for adults. Since 1999, the Center for Disease Control has recommended all children residing in the 11 endemic states be vaccinated to prevent this disease. Oregon is one of the states targeted by the Center for Disease Control for this vaccination recommendation. We know from past experience with other vaccinations that the only way to successfully protect the population from a disease is to implement a universal vaccination program whose goal is, over time, to successfully vaccinate all persons. For the past 20 years, states have been using a school entry program as a means to assure that all children are vaccinated, and thus, over time, all persons will become vaccinated. I understand the Department of Human Services supports the effort to move forward with a school entry requirement, but lacks the resources to fully implement such a program. It is my understanding that there are possible savings accruing to the state from a combination vaccine recently available, which will reduce the number of shots required for kids by 6. This reduction will save the state approximately $600,000 by not paying doctors to administer these shots. Redirecting these funds will assure adequate funding for a school entry hepatitis A program. I request that you, through a budget note, redirect the savings from the reduction in the number of shots and direct the department to implement regulations for school entry hepatitis A requirement beginning with the 2006 school year. The American Liver Foundation is committed to educating parents, teachers, and providers on the importance of hepatitis A vaccination. We are currently working with vaccine manufacturers and the Department of Human Services to develop and implement, at little or no cost to the state, an education program. We will continue our mission to prevent, treat, and cure hepatitis and liver disease, and we hope you will use every available avenue to join us as we pursue a healthier community. And sincerely, Barbara Hernandez, Chapter Director. And you, could you make copies of this for the members so that they could have it in their file? And with that,
it's been a pleasure, Madam Chair, spending these 3 weeks with you.
Was it better than our New York trip?
No. I'm sorry to say.
Well, we've gone through a lot of information over a 3-week period of time, and we still have work yet to do on the budgets. But I do thank you for all the material, and I thank you for responding to all the questions of this panel. And I know that sometimes we ask a lot, and I just want to thank you for your expeditious response to the questions. And with that, until we go into work session, there's someone else that will be sitting there instead of you. So we are adjourned until Monday.
Thank you.